If you love a piece of music, chances are you want to know more about the musician, what event prompted them to write a particular song, or what happened in the studio during the recording, the good, the bad, and of course, the ugly. At minimum, maybe you want to know who produced an album and who it's dedicated to. Well, you can find this kind of thing on liner notes, the printed little pamphlets that are slipped inside a CD or a vinyl cover. Hip-hop music never really had liner notes, not even for seminal, political hip-hop groups like Public Enemy.
But it'll take a black one to move me. Get me the hell away from this TV. All this news and views are beneath me. So all I hear about is shots ringing out about gang putting each other's head out.
So that meant that a lot of stories that told the evolution of this American genre of music went untold. Brian Coleman is a music journalist and a hip-hop junkie. He wrote the anthology Check the Technique, and now he's come out with Check the Technique Volume 2. He profiles 25 albums from the 1980s and 90s and features 80 interviews with the people who helped make the music. It's more than 500 pages, a big endeavor, and he says there's a big audience for it.
I think the reason is it's just the fans, and it's not just specific to hip-hop, always want to know more. And I always wanted to know more. When I was listening to something, you kind of make up these mythologies in your own mind about what was happening when these albums were made, and what were they thinking when they did this, but you never actually knew for sure. The reason that hip-hop specifically never had it was there's an immediacy to hip-hop music and the art form and honestly the industry. And it's as soon as it gets done, the first thing you think about is not, oh, let's do liner notes and let's make a beautiful package. It's let's get it out to the radio. Let's get it out on the streets. Let's start selling it.
Because it's so topical?
Keep in mind, hip hop was never an album-based format in its earliest years. It was always single-based because it's also youth music and young people want to have what's the hippest, latest thing. So sitting on an album after you finished it for 6 months was just not a reality.
Okay, so if you're writing now in this Volume 2 of Check the Technique about songs that came out in the 80s and 90s, who did you get to talk now and what took them so long?
Well, I think now it's people are starting to ask them more. Somebody at a recent book event I did asked me, like, how did you get all these secrets out of all these artists? And I said they weren't secrets, just nobody ever asked them these questions, and there's a difference.
Was it hard to get people to talk, though?
No.
I mean, talk about speaking with Ice Cube. You had an hour and a half long interview with him.
Yeah.
Was it hard to get, and was it hard to pull information from him?
Sometimes some of the artists can be hard to get. The interviews themselves are never difficult. Once you get them kind of on the hook, so to speak, it's easy to reel them in because they love talking about this. They're talking about usually their first or second album at a more innocent time in their career where the industry hadn't fully kind of taken hold of them. And they love talking about these early triumphs that they had.
It's funny. In a way, you're benefiting from them looking in hindsight. Because they have more perspective.
Totally. Well, you don't have the same perspective. If liner notes had been done originally, they would be different than they are now 15, 20 years later because these people can look back through a lens of an entire career versus when they were 17, 18, 19 years old and their whole worldview is completely different.
So tell us more about your talk with Ice Cube.
So Ice Cube, the thing that was cool about that was clearly Ice Cube has better things to do than to talk to me for an hour and a half. It doesn't benefit his career. He saw my last book, felt it was important enough, and spent the time. So I was honored by that. I pretty much wanted to know everything from Cube. There's a lot of mystery around that album specifically, his first one, America's Most Wanted, because he had just left NWA. For example, like a song like Once Upon a Time in the Projects, which is a funny song and a great storytelling song, but how many of those stories were actually true?
I sat on the couch, but it wasn't stable. And then I put my knives on a coffee table. Her brother came in, he's in the gang banging, cause he walked up and said, "What's that you claim?"
Were they true?
This happens to me fairly often. They'll say, well, some of them were and some of them weren't, but they won't say exactly which ones. There's a balance between knowing every single thing and then having some things left to your imagination. And keep in mind, maybe he wants to save it for his own book. He doesn't want to give everything to me, which is fine with me, too. I have no problems with that.
Is it true that you used a cassette recorder, which I have great respect for, by the way, when you were interviewing these hip-hop artists, and that you actually hand-transcribed the notes?
That is true. And I tell people that, especially writers that are younger than I am, that I do that. And they're like, you're an idiot. Like, what is the matter with you?
I think it's great.
It's by far the least efficient way you could do it. But it also allows you to become that much closer with the material and kind of experience it on one extra level. I will continue to do it as long as they continue to make cassette tapes and as long as my equipment still works.
Let's hear another example of a song that you write about and a group you write about. This is a song by the group Stetsasonic. It's from their 1988 album, In Full Gear. The song is Talkin' All That Jazz.
Well, here's how it started. Heard you on the radio, talking about rap, saying all that crap about how we sample, giving examples. Think we'll let you get away with that. You criticize our method of how we make records. You said it wasn't art, so now we're gonna rip you apart.
Stop. Check it out, my man. This is the music of a hip-hop band, jazz.
This was an important song. It was basically Stetsasonic sticking up for hip-hop. There was a jazz artist named James M. Toomey. He basically was on a radio interview saying, oh, with this hip-hop stuff, and they don't know what they're doing, and they're just pushing buttons. So this also kind of talks about where hip-hop was in 1987, 1988. People were still saying it was a fad. People were still saying these guys have no talent. They're just pushing buttons. This is not like being in a rock band or a jazz group or anything like that. So this was really Stetsasonic saying, we're going to stand up for hip hop and we're not going to let somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about talk about us and talk about our peers like that.
You see, you misunderstood. A sample just a tactic, a portion of my method, a tool.
In fact, it's
only of importance when I make it a priority.
And what we sample's love by the majority. But you and
now, the interesting irony is that James M. Toomey later on made a lot of money when Notorious B.I.G. sampled him on this song called Juicy that was an M. Toomey song. So now you talk to him and he's a big hip-hop fan. But that's why that song is great, because it's also, it's catchy, you can dance to it, it had a great video, but it was making a statement. And that's really when hip-hop achieves its highest state, is when it combines all of those things.
So this is the perspective that you want to get in the invisible liner notes.
Definitely.
The liner notes that are now in print.
There's a lot going on in that song, and that's exactly what these books are all about, is kind of getting to the bottom of the complexity of all this stuff.
If somebody were to read this book, say, in 20, 30 years, what's the story it will tell?
I think it tells innovation, and it talks about artistic innovation and ways to express yourself, because there's no one way to express yourself. And this doesn't just stand for hip-hop. This can be anything in rock or reggae or folk music or whatever. But hip-hop has always been a unique thing in that you need certain kind of equipment to do it. Generally, you need a sampler at a drum machine or that kind of thing, and it's what you do with it, because everyone has the same kind of palette in front of them, but it's like, how do you work with that? So innovation, and then the second thing is community, and that can be a community at a record label, at a management company, so Def Jam Records or Rush Artist Management. They managed Public Enemy and Run DMC back in the 80s. It can be a certain studio. There's a studio called D&D Studios in New York City. A lot of people congregated around there. So they were meeting places where even if you weren't the person recording, you might stop by and you would hear what other people were doing and be like, wow. And you would get inspired by that and try and outdo it. And that created some really, truly incredible music.
Brian Coleman is a music journalist and historian. His new book is called Check the Technique, Volume 2, More Liner Notes for Hip-Hop Junkies. Thanks so much for coming in, Brian.
It was a true pleasure. I appreciate it.
I'm wrestling with words and ideas. My ears prick, seeking what will transmit. The scribes can apply to transcript. Yo, this ain't no time where the usual is suitable. Tonight alive, let's describe the inscrutable, the indisputable.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. We're in for Jeremy Hobson and Robin Young. It's Here and Now.